So yesterday we laid out the sugya. We laid out the sugya. I'm going to do this on my recorder, not on my phone. This way it doesn't run the risk of knocking Yonatan out. So we outlined the basic questions. So to review, the beginning of the sugya deals with the authority of community members to make rules for each other. Chet Amud Bet. Ten Amud Aleph deals with seemingly a similar rule because the Gemara invokes the principles from the first half of the sugya for the members of a certain profession. In both cases, we said, where does the authority come from? And is one simply the microcosm of the other such that you can derive principles from one to the other? In the second half of the Gemara, in the case of the guilds, the Gemara introduces this notion that in a case, when you set up a rule that has a consequence to it, you need the Adam Chashuv to sign off on it. And we said, we don't know what that means, right? Does this, who is the Adam Chashuv? Is it a rabbinic leader? Is it a political leader? Is it a guild professional, right? A super butcher or something? And what does his presence teach you? Does it teach you that really authority is top down? Does it teach you that authority is bottom up, but there's a corrective, right? Just to make sure that it's okay, right? Is this the philosopher king of Plato, right? That really leaders are what, you know, these smart people should guide all the uneducated masses, right? Or is he just, you know, a corrective, but really power is bottom up? Is it different between the case of the city and the case of the guild, right? Are these powers identical? Is the role of the Adam Chashuv the same? Right, all those questions were what we had dealt with yesterday. Okay? And I'm going to stipulate, as I have in many sugyas, but in this sugya is particularly true, I will stipulate that you will not hold me responsible for being exhaustive of the sources. If you don't hold me responsible to be exhaustive, I won't hold you responsible to read all the sources I would give you in order to be exhaustive. Okay, this is our deal. This is our deal. But at the end, you can't tell me, oh, but you forgot something, because maybe I did forget it, maybe I never saw it, but you won't know. It could just be something that I chose not to give you, okay? I think I'm going to give you Benny Brown's article and let you guys breathe for a day. It is a fascinating philosophical tour, and it also has all the relevant tshuvot translated into English with his analysis of it, and I do want to discuss it one day for labor unions and strikes and stuff like that. I was debating making you read all the tshuvot in the original, but then I discovered that he translated all the relevant portions of the key tshuvot in English with analysis, so, you know, I think I'm going to be nice to you on one day, and never expect me to be nice to you again, but, you know, no, Povisham, I'll do it. Benny Brown is one of the best scholars of this type of halachic writing, in modern times. He's great. He did it on the Chafetz Chaim. He has this 1,000-page tome on the Chazon Ish, which is cool, but still. Fine, but that's what we did yesterday. So I sent you a few representative sources. I'm still with you, but I'm looking at them, but I hopefully won't lose you, okay? Yonatan. So I send you a few representative sources here. Let us look at some suggestive sources. And again, these are not meant to be exhaustive. I gave you some suggestive sources. Okay. So let's look at what I gave you from the Ritva. Okay? I gave you the Ritva on Chet Amud Bet. So, okay, remind me again, bios. By the end of the year, you'll know it. Right? The Ritva's name is Yom Tov, right? Right? Rabbeinu Yom Tov from Seville, right? Ala Sevili, right? Okay. So, he writes, what does he write? Someone want to read the Ritva for me?
Sure.
Go. Oh, Yaakov. Yaakov, go ahead.
Okay.
New volunteers here. Good. Okay, right. So first he says, what does lasial kitzotam mean? It means to? Right, to fine, to punish someone. And what's his proof? What's his example? The tabache, what's that? Right, no, the case of this, right, the uvda of the tabache, the story of the slaughterers, what was the story? Remember, Tedamut Beis, Tedamut Aleph, rather. It was stealing each other's work day, and therefore what was the consequence? What was the punishment?
Yeah,
You know, remember they shredded his the leather, right? Anyone? What? Well, what? Yeah, but that was the punishment that they had, right? So that's what Lasiel Kitzatam means, that they can make rules and enforce them with punishment. Kolomar sheyasiuhu min di Torah. Right? Which means that they can either, right, take him out, right, of din Torah, meaning this is beyond the letter of the law. Omi mamo no. Right? Meaning they can, right, basically chase him out from the strict letter of the law, trace him away from his own money. Omenair, what does that mean? Yeah, well, so meaning we can chase him out of town. Right? He doesn't listen. So now he says, and what is the basis for this power? Very good. Mishum de hefker beit in hefker ki dechtiv v'chol asher yavau l'shloshet yamim. And he quotes the pasuk for the source of hefker beit in hefker from as it appears in the sugya in Yevamot. Okay, very good. Someone tell me what this source tells you. Tell me a problem with this source. Someone tell me what is going on in this source that is weird. You're all looking at me. There's nothing weird about this at all. It makes perfect sense. With? He doesn't explain why what? Does he say anything about Adam Chashuv? No. Does he say anything about a Beit Din? Yeah. He does. Does the Gemara say anything about a Beit Din?
No.
No. So someone tell me what just happened.
I mean, rabbis took power.
What?
What
rabbis?
He's saying that the rabbis...
There are no rabbis here. What are you talking about? He says that this rule is based on Hefker Beit Din Hefker. In the case of the people of the city, are the Beit Din making the rules?
Yes.
No! Where did you see an indication the Beit Din made the rules? In the case of the guilds, is the Beit Din making the rule?
No!
Right, they're not making the rules.
Right, but I mean, you say the
Adam Chashuv is the... Did we say anything about Adam Chashuv yet? Is there a Bezdin here? Is there a Beit Din in play? Is that who set the rules?
No, but if there's...
No!
You have a third person who's Mumchah, then Mumchah's Beit Din.
Who said Mumchin? Did he say such a qualification?
I mean, that's Adam Chashuv.
Is Adam Chashuv on Cherem et Bet? Not explicitly. Yes, Adam. On Tenem and Aleph he did. He went to Rava, right? But that, okay. So let's try to figure out what he means. So one possibility is to go in the direction that Ezra's going in, and Adam's going in, which is to say, oh, if the Ritva says Hefker Beit Din Hefker, he must either assume that there was a Beit Din here, or that the other Chashuv tells you that fundamentally what's going on is some sort of top-down power, like Hefker Beit Din Hefker. Right? Or something like that, right? Yes, Ezra.
What legislative body is making
rules? Oh, good. The problem is, with doing what we just said, is that does there seem to be any indication here that there was a Beis Din making the rules?
There has to be some form of legislative body.
Yeah, oh, very good. Very good. What seems to be the legislative body here? And this is where I was. Okay, this is what I wanted from you. Thank you. Here's the big question. When we talk about the power of Beit Din, where does the power of Beit Din come from? Very good. So one can look at the power of Beit Din, even the power of Beit Din, as fundamentally intrinsic, top-down, from Torah. But Beit Din often is not really Beit Din. What is Beit Din, Ezra?
Can you
It's not even that. This isn't a Beit Din.
You have two guys, and then are we currently talking about the Tawafi case, or are we talking about this general?
He's talking about general. He's talking about Chenam and Bet.
Because with the case of the butchers, you can just say basically said, well, because you have two guys, and then they take a third person, you can say, and then boom, that's arbitration, and it comes from the fact that they agree to it, and they can do whatever.
So, you could assume that this is actually some sort of Beis Din. But it could also be, and there's good reason to believe this in the Sugya, because there is no discussion of an actual Beis Din. At best, there's a discussion of Adam Chashuv on Tedem and Aleph, is that, in general, some rabbinic power derives from their knowledge of Torah, from God. But Beis Din, often, that's not where their power comes from. Their power comes from the people. They are the representatives of the people. But the power essentially comes from the people. And therefore, all relevant powers that come to Beis Din, by virtue of the fact that they represent the people, where does the power actually lie? In the people. Yeah, this wasn't hard. In the people. And therefore, what's the simplest understanding of a Gemara? Who's making these rules? The people. The people. We haven't yet talked about how they're voting. Rov, Kulam, we'll see that. We'll see that. But the simplest understanding is that our Sugya is not talking about a legislative decision made by a Beit Din, and it's made by the people. And if the Ritva is willing to invoke the line of Hefker Beit Din Hefker to describe the power that comes from the people, then what does he seem to think about Hefker Beit Din Hefker? What? But where does it come from? The people, right? Meaning it's not one of those powers that comes to the government by virtue of their knowledge of Torah. It seems to be one of those powers that comes to the leaders by virtue of the fact that there's a certain power that inheres in the people. And the Beis Din represents them. In this case, they don't. But if the Beis Din derives its power from the people, then who obviously maintains some level of that power? The people. Right? Now, I debated. And then I decided to be nice. Right? I just decided to be nice. And decided to not give you the, 25 places in the Tshuvot HaRashba where he deals with these questions. But the Rashba in several places does have formulations of the people of the town are like Sanhedrin HaGadol for themselves. Something like that. Right? They are their own, right? That seems to be, and the Rav talked a lot about this. I heard it from Lichtenstein, I heard it from Rosenzweig, that even the Sanhedrin HaGadol HaYoshev Yerushalayim has these two roles. Right? Part of their power is that they are the Sanhedrin HaGadol, and God wants the Torah represented, but part of it is that they represent the people, and some of their power comes from the people. And there's this delicate balance, and let me just give you one indication, okay? That at least some of rabbinic power is not simply by virtue of the fact that they know Torah, but it comes from the people. There's a rule about legislation, which is if the rabbis make a piece of legislation and everybody ignores it, then what force does that legislation have? Nothing. Nothing. The rule is that kol gzeira she'ein rov hatzibur yecholin la'amod ba. Any decree that the majority of Kol Yisrael, one second, Yonatan, I see your hand, can't stand up to is not effective. And therefore, now, if the tzibur accepts it and then years later people can accept it, so it still stands. But if no one ever accepted it, then the power Right? Then they didn't have power. It's just an illegitimate law, and it just disappears. Now, were the people right or wrong to violate the laws? I don't know. Right? But the fact is that they don't have the power, because there are these indications. I was listening on my way to and from yeshiva for a little bit to one of my... So I was listening to the shirim from one of my friends from yeshiva, who is currently a magid shir at YU and a dayan on the Beis Din of America, Rabbi Itamar Rosenzweig, who gave like a 6-part shir, each of them an hour and a half, on this line of Lahasiya al Kitzatan, going through all the Tshuvat HaRashba and the Tshuvat HaTashbeitz and relevant Tshuvot, and he spent a lot of time going through the implicit political theory that emerged from these types of sources, right, where they equate the power of the people with the power of Beit Din, because they really do seem to believe at some level that the power of the Beit Din, of the leaders, emerges from the people, right? That some, especially their legislative power, and this is, then I'll take Yonatan's question, especially legislative power, right? There are these indications that, right, judicial power, the fact that they can adjudicate the law may come top down, right? That God gave the laws and now someone has to judge them. So whoever happens to know the Torah well enough can weigh in. But legislative power, right, the power to create law seems to be something that they get insofar as it is granted to them by people. Right? And therefore, I think that's what the Ritva is getting at, and I opted to give you the Ritva's very short formulation rather than the very long formulation in the Tshuva HaRashba. But I think that's what he's getting at, is that that political power, there is this model of political power in Torah that emerges from the people. Now, you can figure out how you view that. Do you view that because of social contract, right? Is that how you think it comes? Or, I don't know, pick your favorite political theory as to why power inheres in the people. What?
Georgism.
What?
Georgism.
Georgism?
Your favorite political theory.
What is Georgism?
Just socialism for land. Every
life. Ah, okay. So whatever theory you think, it does seem to be that at least the most plausible, the simplest understanding is that legislative power in Torah, at least a lot of it, really is invested in the people, and therefore, to some extent, that's outsourced to the Beis Din under certain circumstances, right? Which is basically social contract theory, right? Is the power inheres in the people, but by accepting the government, right, they've now entered into a contract in which the power that emerged from them has now been outsourced into the government authorities to enforce it on them. Right? That's, in a nutshell, social contract theory, right? Why do we do that? Because otherwise we'll eat each other alive, and right, the natural state of man and whatever. We can talk about variations in you know, different political philosophers and whatever. We can talk about Rousseau, we can talk whatever. Okay? I don't know how much you know political theory, but we can talk about it, right? That's not for now. But I think that the Ritva is going in that same direction as the Rashba, in that sense, where the power, essentially there's this notion that for whatever political theory you want to put in, power emerges from the people, and therefore sometimes that looks like the government who represents the people, but in this case, where the people themselves decide to make rules. So, obviously, if the Beis Din has the power of Hefker, Beis Din, Hefker, and that power came from them being the representatives of the people, and the people giving them that power, then the power, when the people choose to use that power directly, they have it. Right? They have it because that's where power is. Now, there are other theories, admittedly. There are the Dvar Avram has this theory about Hefker, Beis Din, Hefker, that based on Rashi and Tosafot, that power is, I don't want to say self-justifying, but almost self-justifying. Meaning, power gives you authority, authority gives you power. Right? If you're powerful enough to enforce your will, then you have that power, sort of by definition. It sounds a little bit circular, but this is how he reads Rashi and Tosafot. that model here we'd have to talk about, right? Is it, and I guess, if the people are able to enforce their will, so then they're able to enforce it, and they have the right to do that, right? And you got to figure out the difference between right and ability and things like that. But I think that's what the Ritva is getting at, and that's really the key here. And once you say that, you understand how you could have a microcosm of this in the case of the guilds, right? Because if power inheres in the people, so everybody in the profession may have that type of power also, at least for certain circumstances. Okay, I'll let Yonatan go first. Yonatan, unmute yourself before you do it, because otherwise I'll just see your... I don't want to have to read your mouth. Yeah, go.
Yeah. So it seems
like... Say hello, everyone. Say hello to Yonatan. Hi, everyone. Yeah. Okay, yes, Yonatan.
Like you could say that it's not that there is a power in the people, or the people that give to the Beit Din, but rather the Beit Din has all the power, and if the people don't follow a decree or something, it's very difficult or nearly impossible for the Beit Din to force people to adhere to it if they're not following it. And that would be a reason why it kind of goes away if people don't follow it.
So Yehonadan is pointing out that the example I gave is not ironclad, right? The proof from Kol Beit Din Kol Gzeir Shein Tzimur Yechol Lamud Ba, that's not a great proof, because you could look at that and say a certain level of legislative power lies in the hand of the people, and therefore if they don't accept it, they don't accept it. But you could go in the opposite direction, which is say no, fundamentally power is top down, but there is an escape clause, which is if it has never been followed, then it can't really be plausibly said to be law, because, right, something is law if it's enforceable, right? If it's not enforceable because no one ever kept it, then it ceases to be law simply because it's a meaningless law, right? It's like trying to enforce jaywalking, right? At some point, it just became, in America at least in certain places, it just became like a law on the books that's unenforceable and no one will ever enforce it. That's not true everywhere. In Canada and Israel, they give out tickets for jaywalking. Yes, I know. It was crazy. Aura had to, like, you know, Aura and I had trouble with this, because, like, I'm, you know, fourth generation New York City. The reason you jaywalk, it's like, why do you jaywalk? I'm like, because the closest way of getting from two points is a straight line. That's the obvious reason to jaywalk, right, is... in Washington Heights at, like, cross Amsterdam at, like, you know, a huge angle, because that would cut down my, you know, it's shorter than an L, right? Okay, so it's a busy street in Manhattan. Whatever, right? Like, you know, Torontonians don't do this. This is not something they do. And, like, why do you cross at a red light? I'm like, because there are no cars coming. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I what can you do? Yes, I'm not saying you should do what I'm doing, but, like, you're not going to get it out of my system. Like, jaywalking is just a way of life. But yeah, Yehonatan might be right. It could be that you could justify that rule not in a top-down, not in a bottom-up approach, but a top-down approach, and saying, fundamentally, law should come from the top down. It's just not law. If it's no one's keeping it, therefore it's not enforceable. It just sort of, it becomes dead, right? Because it just isn't, right? That's possible. Right now, of course, that would still indicate that there's a certain relevance to the people who are listening to the laws, but it would still conceptualize the system more from the top down, admittedly. But that's what I think is going on in the Ritva, and that the Ritva is basically saying, that by saying it's Hefker Bez Nefsker, even though we're not dealing with Bezdin, I think the Ritva is going in this direction, right? That there is, that the power comes from the people, and therefore, if they decide, just like Bezdin has the power to control monetary law, a warplane, who knew? What? There's an Air Force base not so far from here. Yeah. I don't know. Migdal's under attack. I have no idea. I don't know. Like, it's probably a routine whatever. Every Monday night I hear it in the Gush, because there's a little airfield by us also, and I think it's Mondays. I didn't know. I never really noticed a pattern, but I think that was the day they do training. But there's a few Air Force bases not so far from here. My sister worked on one for a while. when she was in the army. She was on an Air Force base. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe that's the one coming back from Damascus. I don't know. Right? Didn't Damascus say this morning that Israelis sent some attack planes into Syria? I don't know what it is. I saw it in the reflection of my plastic box, okay? I don't know. I just want to point out, I saw the plane in the reflection of my plastic box and in the corner of of Yehonatan's screen that I'm currently seeing on WhatsApp, I saw the plane behind me, right, through this little box. I did not get a good look at what type of plane it was. Okay. Yeah, but it is possible, right, that... Okay. But I do think that in the end of the day, is for me, the simplest understanding of this sugya, right, is that the reason that these rules are effective is because legislative power inheres in the people, and therefore any authority that we expect to see in Beit Din as their representatives can also be achieved through a direct decision by the people, right? Now, I will point out, maybe this is going a bit afield, but there is indication this is true not just of Beis Din, but of Malchut also. Okay? I feel like I'm getting far afield, but it might help conceptually here. The Gemara says that Ein Moshchen Melech Ben Melech. Right, the first king of a dynasty, you anoint them. But you don't need to anoint the heir to a dynasty because he's already king by right. Unless his kingship is called into machloket. Right? Unless there was a dispute like Shlomo HaMelech with Adonio. Now Rashi, in the two places this appears, has two different views. In Horiot, in the third parak, when he discusses this sugya, he says, really, you're not really anointing him because he's still king. You're anointing him just to quell machloket, right? By making a public display that the person is king. So you're making sure that people know he's king, that's all. But Rashi in Krito and Davhei, when the sugya appears, says that when there's a machloket about who should be king, he actually isn't king. Meaning, even the king, his authority comes from the fact that people accepted him. So if the people just accept the heir to the throne, so then he doesn't need to be re-anointed because he inherited the throne from his father. But if there's a challenge to it, like a real challenge from the people, right, that there are people following different kings, then that machloket means because there wasn't that unanimous acceptance of the king, that actually affects his status as king. So Rashi seems to have this conceptualization that even the power of the monarch fundamentally emerges from the people. And this became very important because Rav Kook, in a celebrated tshuva, I'm doing some religious Zionist stuff for you, Yehonatan, right? Rav Kook, in a celebrated tshuva in Mishpat Kohen, tshuva Kuf Mem Dalet, says that really the power of the king is the power of the people which has been given to the king. But therefore, if there's no king, the power goes back to the people, and they can do with that power what they want. And therefore, if Cook says, since in modern Israel there is no king, the power went back to the people, and the people chose to pick not a monarchy, but a democracy. And therefore, it's what is sometimes described as a malchut without a melech. Right? That all halachot that are relevant to the person of the king doesn't apply in modern Israel because there is no melech. But all halachic rules that apply not to melech but to malchut actually do apply to an Israeli democracy, because since the power of melech is really the power of the people that they vested in the king, when there's no king it goes back to the people and they can allocate it however they want, and therefore the basic authority emerges from the koach hamalchut. Yeah, but meaning the fact that it has halachic significance, like things like Dina d'Malchut Dina, right? That even the king makes a decree that isn't Torah-based, but you have to listen because of the power of the king. So the same way is we could set up secular laws, but be bound by them because we've invested them with the power that is inherent in the system of Malchut by giving them the power that the people have, that they usually give a king, right? And therefore, you could give halachic weight to non-halachic, right, not anti-halachic laws, but to non-halachic laws, right, to neutral laws. Oh, very good. Okay, so I see we're not going to get a chance to do it, but I'm glad you ended us this way. But Yaakov says, and this is the big setup for some of the things we talk about, which is, okay, but how does this work? Because if what I'm saying is correct, that the power fundamentally inheres in the people, and that's where they get the power to make decisions, so then you have to correctly ask, but wait a second, not everybody makes that, right? In the case of Israel, the majority of the representatives in the Knesset make the laws, right? We don't even have, like, a constitution, and even our basic laws can be overturned by 61. So, you know, whatever, right? But that's going to be one of the major machlokot, and again, to shortcut it, I didn't give you all the shitot, but I do want you to look at the Mordechai, which I told you already yesterday, tough pay. But you'll see that the question of whether, remember we talked about this yesterday, the question of whether we're talking about Rov or Kulo is relevant here. Because, well, you tell me very quickly, and we'll see it inside, I guess, next time, is if you had conceptualized this not the way we did today, but as contract law, which is what Rami was doing yesterday, then how many people need to sign on to this thing? What? Yeah, everyone is going to be affected by it. But if you say that what's going on here is not a mere contract, but is... yeah, it's political power, right? It's a political law. So then just like we don't expect unanimity for every single law, right? Even in America, even constitutional change, we need, right? We don't need 100%, right? We need two-thirds, three-quarters, yes? Right, two-thirds of Congress, three-quarters of the states, right? Fine, right? We don't need unanimity. Right, when it comes to political laws, we often accept Rove because the power invests in the people, but you're part of a group. And therefore, by being part of this group, the decision is made by this corporate entity called the city, called the guild, called the whatever. And therefore, the decision isn't made by everybody because you don't need to explicitly sign on. This is not contract law. It's, right, it's political power which emerges from the people. And if you choose to be part of the city, so then decisions are made by majority. But remember, there might be a difference. It might be that this one will be true about the city laws, and a different will be true about the guild principles, right? Or another distinction that we'll see, and I want, you know, you'll start thinking about this, is it depends. Is this a law that has a consequence or not? Meaning, you can make laws without punishment, and you can make laws that have sanctions attached to them. Do you need different type of power justify each of those? Right? And these are the types of things that the Mefarshim are going to talk about. Again, I'm shortcutting it for you and giving you a few representative sources and giving you Shulchan Aruch where you see it. Some of these positions. Okay, but that's one theory that I want you to get in your heads. Again, the Rajva develops it and many of the Rishonim develop this type of theory, but I want you to, right, that's one model that we should really be thinking of. Okay, I know that was a mini